There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit YahooFinance.com, the number one financial destination, YahooFinance.com.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, is the BBC planning to take ads in the UK? We look into a curious story from the Times this week and its implications for British audio businesses. Also on the programme, how's that BBC local radio strategy doing? The head of BBC England's radio stations talks to us about the next phase. And all that, plus GB News get wrapped by Ofcom, YMU tools up with new talent, and in the media quiz, we get specific. That's all to come in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, a crack team of experts are being seconded to the DCMS to help decide the way the BBC is funded in the future. The panel includes veteran Sir Peter Bazalgette, Radio Centre ex-boss Siobhan Kenny, and Channel 5's first boss, David Two Brains Elstein. The Media Podcast hotline must not have been working that day. ITV have renewed their PSB licence for another 10 years, despite warnings just a few years ago that it may change course. The commercial broadcaster committed to making public service content for the foreseeable, and as such remains at number 3 in the EPG across the country. Google has been fined €250 million in France for the way it used the country's news outlets to train its AI. It's the first test of a new EU law designed to protect intellectual property and its neighbouring rights, which has allowed publishers to demand compensation for use of their content. And joining me at the London Podcast Studios to cover the other media stories of the week, we welcome back the head of TV the Indie Gold Waller, Faraz Osman.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm all right. I'm fasting again. You did this to me last year when you got me on the pod, and we record this just as I'm going to start eating. And now you've got Alex Farber, who has a habit of getting like gossip out of me. So this is like a really dangerous, treacherous time for me, because God knows what's going to happen, where Alex is going to noodle me for something, and I don't before I even realise it, there's going to be some gossip that gets dropped.
It's almost like it's a plan. BAFTA TV award noms announced this week.
Yeah, they were.
Anything that caught your attention?
It's going to be a bit of a tricky year, because telly is in a bit of a weird space right now, so you've got to get the tone right about what you want to celebrate. But you want to celebrate it because you want to tell everybody, look at the amazing stuff we've done. So there's stuff that you would expect to see. Happy Valley's in there. The Crown is raising a few eyebrows, because I think a lot of people were less admiring.
Slightly off the boil.
Yeah, of the last season of The Crown. But it's done very well in these noms. Top Boy has done incredibly well, as I think it should do. There's a lot of recognition to be had there. There's some really great new talent out. Mwan's been nominated for Juice, I think, probably 3 times all over the place, because the Craft Awards come out as well, which aren't televised. Dreaming Whilst Black continues to kind of get lots of recognition that it deserves. So that's really exciting. The only thing I'd say about it is that because of the nominations, when the nomination window opens, and then when these are announced, and obviously when the awards happen, it's quite a long time.
Yes, so it seems like things, old shows.
Yeah, so something that is conspicuously absent. So there's no Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. There's no Gladiators. There's no Traitors. You know, they won last year. You would expect them to be in it this year. That's not there. So there's lots of things, because there has been a bit of a purple patch of great shows on TV that aren't being celebrated here. So, yeah, there's still more to come, is what I would say. There's lots more shows to recognise.
And next to Faraz, we have the Times media correspondent, Alex Farber. Hello.
Hello, Matt.
Speaking of awards, you've been at the Broadcasting Press Guild Awards this afternoon, as have I. What were your highlights?
Oh, well, it was a good award. So what stood out for me? There was Happy Valley got Best Drama Series, Sarah Lancashire, Best Actress, Best Writer for Sally Wainwright, so that did well. Mr. Bates versus the Post Office that Faraz just mentioned, that was recognised there.
They got a special award.
They got a special award, and it made a significant impact. There was a standing ovation. Toby Jones was there. I was sat next to Joe Hamilton.
Oh, yes.
I was sat next to Joe Hamilton.
The real Joe Hamilton.
The real Joe Hamilton.
From the post office.
Yeah, from the post office. So that was a bit of a privilege, and it was nice to see them get a standing ovation. The other highlight for me was Andy Harries. He collected... He's he's the producer behind The Crown and many, many other shows. He runs...
He had an amazing showreel of his sort of 25, 35 years of success, didn't he?
Incredible. I mean, it felt like it went on for about 25 minutes, but it was all killer and no filler. Mm. So, you know, he was a very big, big popular winner on the night. And finally, I've got to give mention to Russell Brand in Plain Sight, the dispatches that Channel 4 worked on with my colleagues at the Times and the Sunday Times.
I thought you were going to say that Russell Brand was there in Plain Sight, and I was a bit like, that is a scoop.
That would have been quite the moment. And finally, it's our Antipodean audio correspondent and Pod News editor, the perma jet lagged James Cridland. Hi, James.
G'day.
What's the big story in Australia at the moment?
Oh, it's all about consolidation. It's all about media consolidation. I mean, it's either that or the entire country's on fire or underwater. SCA and Bauer, SCA and ARN are merging. And the reason why I say SCA and Bauer is ARN's essentially the Bauer. SCA is essentially the Global. Both of those organisations are merging, the two big radio companies are merging together. And that's going to be absolutely fascinating.
And is that going to happen? Because there's always some discussions about will it pass the rules. Is the general view that thing is going to happen?
Yeah, the general rule is that it'll pass the rules in terms of the media ownership laws. The way that they're doing it is they're splitting into two companies, which may sound familiar to us here in the UK. There will be whatever this new company is going to be called, which will own half of the licenses, because you're only allowed to own two licenses in each radio market. Another radio company will own the other two, but will be presumably licensing brands and that sort of thing.
And they're doing an interesting thing of sort of merging their digital operations.
Yes.
So it's sort of, from the outside, it sort of looked like a clever, sort of semi-clever wheeze to get around the old analog rules whilst sort of being merged together for the digital future.
Yes, I mean, I think the question at the moment is who will win? Will it be iHeart, which is essentially a licensing deal for the iHeart brand in Australia? Will that be the predominant brand that wins, or will it be the Listener brand, which is a homegrown brand that SCA has put together? Now, SCA's done all of the tech for that, so that's interesting and exciting, and it's something that they own. But is the iHeart brand stronger? So it'll be interesting seeing who wins there.
And you've got an interesting situation where iHeart, the American sort of audio digital brand, licensed to Australia, as you say, and owned 15% by Global in the UK.
Yes.
So that could end up being the thing that's everywhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, it could well be. Maybe Global will actually be global by name and global by nature.
Yes, we will see. Right, so let's start with one of Alex's stories. This week it was revealed that the BBC is making plans to feature advertising on its audio output when distributed on third-party platforms. Alex, tell us more.
Yeah, this is an interesting and somewhat surprising story. The BBC, traditionally almost exclusively funded by the licence fee, as well as some commercial sales. And as part of that commercial income, it's going to start running adverts around its radio shows and on-demand radio programmes when they appear on third-party services.
So these are things like Apple or Spotify?
Yeah, this isn't... So you'll still be able to get all the shows ad-free on BBC Sounds, it's worth saying. But nevertheless, they think that audiences are sufficiently familiar with adverts on those platforms and that they will not be out of kilter for them to also hear adverts on BBC podcasts, which, you know, is quite a departure from a traditionally non-ad environment.
Faraz, I saw this and went, have they gone entirely mad?
Did you?
Yes.
See, I saw this and was a bit like, that's completely common sense to me.
BBC plus ads in the UK.
I think that what it shows is the BBC acknowledging that actually, where we would used to think about things being geo-blocked. So, you know, if you wanted to listen to this show, the only way to listen to this show in the UK was to watch your TV or listen to your radio in the UK. And then BBC America has ads on it. And when you go elsewhere and you see the same shows that you see from back home, and suddenly they've got ad breaks in it. And obviously because they've sold it elsewhere. I think now you look at other platforms that exist, it doesn't really make much sense why, you know, the podcast platforms that, you know, I don't use... I use BBC Sounds when I want to listen to BBC stuff, and then I use Overcast when I want to listen to podcasts. Why is it that that app doesn't have adverts in it when it's obviously not siloed in the walled garden of the BBC. So I kind of think it makes sense. You want to listen to stuff free, listen to it on BBC Sounds. That's not available outside of the UK. And this allows and protects the value of the exclusivity to public service.
What about watching BBC One on Sky?
People are shaking their heads all around me. They're like, no.
What have they done? What about watching BBC One on Sky TV?
Exactly.
No, because I think that is different, because you can't download Sky TV. Well, you can actually, but like I think it's significantly different, because that's a carriage thing, whereas this is just an RSS feed that you can just pull from anywhere. And
but a listener doesn't know the difference. They just assume
in the UK they don't.
But like first run audio that's on Sounds and on Radio 4, and if you happen to use Apple Podcasts, you're going to get ads in it. Do you think listeners will find that a bit weird?
I don't. Well, no, because they do so much promotion to push you to BBC Sounds anyway as an app. That's obviously part of the strategy of why they're doing this. But I think the difference between the Sky analogy and what's happening here is that there is a fluency that we have, that when you're watching something like Sky or Virgin Media or the BBC or Terrestrial, all of those are UK things that are done in UK households. When you look at Apple Podcasts or Overcast or Pocket Cast or whatever, or Spotify, the same system is being used all around the world.
Yeah, but they've already had ads in the outside of the UK on podcasts for a long, long time. So this is the first change. This is the first change from my point of view. Is all of a sudden we're getting ads on BBC content, first run BBC content in the UK for the first time. I think the Sky thing is absolutely right. I'm quite excited about what it means for Open RSS.
Yeah, so I've heard you sort of say this over the last 24 hours. Now, this takes a slightly different view. So there are some people in the podcast space that haven't been big fans of the BBC putting its content exclusively on BBC Sounds. And there's a worry that from some that there'd be more of that and it wouldn't be on Apple and Spotify.
I mean, there's a trial on at the moment, which means that the news quiz, which I would remind you all is a topical news quiz, is delayed by 1 month on Open RSS. Now, when I was at that corporation, a trial had an end date. This does not have an end date. I've asked the press office 4 or 5 times, what's the end date for this trial? And they say, oh, it's just ongoing. Well, that's not a trial, that's a policy. But if you look at what this might mean that I calculated, if you assume 6 ads a podcast, which is typically what most podcasts out there run, that's £90 per 1,000 listens. So if you get 1 million downloads, that's £90,000 on Apple Podcasts and nothing on BBC Sounds. So which are the BBC going to promote? BBC Sounds, where they earn nothing from it, or £90,000, which is not a small amount of money.
So this might be a bit of confusion from my part. And it's interesting you say about the news quiz. I stopped listening to the news quiz for that very reason, because it's started to get delayed on my third-party app, and I just fell out of habit with listening to it. So there is a problem there. But so just to clarify that, is what you're saying that if I have a BBC podcast that I'm using through my third party, I won't hear ads in the UK? But if I got that feed and I was in America, it would pull in the American feed.
So in America at the moment, you would get ads.
On a BBC podcast. So that exists already. That's different.
At the moment in the UK, you don't, but the plan is that you will.
Can I just say something here? I don't think the issue is the audience experience. You know, I do think there's some familiarity with advertising around BBC content, not least through UK TV, right? Which is a BBC-owned portfolio of channels. Dave Gold yesterday, everyone watches ads on them. That's out there.
But it's not what first run.
What the concern? That some of it is, a lot of that is first run. What the concern is that I'm hearing is from the impact that this is going to have on the podcast suppliers and producers in the industry, because this is going to be quite a distortionary effect on the market, whereby I think it's estimated that the advertising market in the UK on podcasts is about a £70 million business, right? Now, that is only going to get diluted by the BBC coming on board. Now, the BBC thinks that they are going to help grow the pie, because as a result of the big established kosher BBC coming on board, that's going to encourage brands that haven't previously embraced podcast advertising to do so. Suppliers are sceptical, and I'm hearing frustration, nervousness from producers that they are going to end up with a smaller slice small producers that they are going to end up with a smaller spot slice of the podcasting spend pie because of the BBC effectively parking its tanks on their lawn. And the other thing I think worth saying is, in BBC gets £3.5 billion worth of licence fee revenue. This is going to generate a relatively small amount of money for what's potentially putting a lot of noses out of joint. And I think the other thing worth saying is people are concerned that it represents the thin end of the wedge, and that what this is a the BBC dipping its toe into an advertising market that it might then seek to push out onto its traditional television channels.
That's all really... I mean, I've swung completely the other way because I misunderstood. My understanding was, outside of the UK and on other apps, then you would see adverts. But if that's happening already outside of UK territories, then yes, this is problems attached to it.
I mean, Alex has got a good point there. Does this sort of queer the pitch a little bit for the BBC's licence fee, next round of licence fee settlement? Have they sort of inadvertently grasped the third rail and it will generate more issues?
I don't think the BBC does anything inadvertently.
I think there is
warrant to say that this might be a bit of an experiment to see how people do take to advertising against
BBC. They've been specifically challenged by the government with being a more commercially focused organisation. The government's made no bones about that. You know, BBC does already have BBC Studios, which generates, you know, what we're talking about, a billion and a half of revenue, returns about £250 million a year revenue to the BBC. The government wants to see the BBC less reliant on the licence fee, you know, not having to ask taxpayers for more money, and, you know, able to stand on its own two feet, support itself a little bit more. And it considers that this is a way in which it can do that.
In addition to that, what I want to know is, do producers get any of this money?
So the Audio UK have said the BBC's discussions are, if you have a programme that goes into this scheme, you will see a cut of that. I know that at the moment, where that happens internationally, there is some disquiet about transparency and where the money comes from. Because in your calculations there, James, it doesn't quite take into account fill rate.
No, of course.
So
of
this course. Is you can
that's,
have
that's assuming that six ads have been sold in every in every download, and of course that's absolutely not the case. What I love listening to is ad-funded shows in Australia, where you hear, and The Rest Is Entertainment is a great example. You hear them saying, and now we'll take a break. Welcome back, because there's absolutely no ads sold.
Well, at the moment, you get that in the UK as well for quite a lot of Rest Is Entertainment breaks because of the fill rate and the pressure on the ad market. There's a bit of me that also thinks the BBC have maybe overestimated what they'll get, because what they're going to take ad-wise isn't everything.
No, and I think, you know, on the other side, they have said that, don't worry, the BBC News will not have any ads in it. And I'd just like to remind the BBC that they run the BBC News channel, which has ads in it outside of the UK. If ads are fine there, why are they not allowed in the audio here?
Are they in news podcasts outside of the UK? Do you get ads in BBC News podcasts?
You get ads in some BBC News podcasts, but of course the BBC News channel, the TV channel, is chock full of ads, and there seems to be no qualms in terms of that. Why would there be qualms in terms of sticking ads in there? And I heard, you know, somebody saying the other day that, you know, we're doing it because, you know, we clearly need to be impartial. Well, does that mean that shows with ads in it aren't impartial anymore? None of that particularly makes an awful lot of sense. So I'm fascinated at seeing how this works. But, you know, it's another example of the BBC jumping into, I mean, you know, that they were wanting to produce a new boom radio the other month. And it just seems to be another way of encroaching into the commercial world, where they have guaranteed revenue from that license fee for a number of years. And commercial, commercial media companies don't.
Well, speaking of news channels, Ofcom has censured GB News for its use of politicians as presenters on news programming. The move is against five separate programs, including those fronted by everyone's favourite, Jacob Rees-Mogg and Esther McVeigh. GB News did not react well to being told that they break the rules.
No, GB News basically said to Ofcom, do one.
Which,
we don't care what you've got to say. We don't think we're doing anything wrong. We're not going to change course. you know, we think we're this is a chilling development. You're sanctioning us. We're not doing anything wrong. And, you know, we have no intention of amending what it is.
They had that statement prepared since they started the channel, yes. didn't they? They probably wrote that statement before they turned the cameras on.
It's freedom of speech.
Yeah.
But I saw that, and because they have changed how they do things, and they've told all their staff to be on best behaviour so they don't get fined. And that best behaviour is following the broadcasting code, which everyone else does.
That's true. But this is specifically around the politicians as presenters ruling, which I think is slightly different, which they have had in place since the beginning, and they have said they're going to stick to. And I think as a point of principle, they don't consider that there is any issue with serving politicians acting as impartial news presenters.
Well, they don't call it news. Well, we're kind of getting into this real world of what is news. Like, the BBC don't need to know what is news anymore, and now GB News, obviously, is GB News news?
Well, the lines are blurring
news?
For us, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is getting, you know, but I think that they are being intentionally blurred for these reasons, and that is, you know, that's obviously what
is that troublesome in a general election year?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I think that that's the real test, because if my maths aren't wrong. If my maths are right, GB News hasn't been on air during an election campaign. And I think that they'll have to pull all those presenters, right? You know, but once we get into an election period, and, you know, the mayor elections are coming up in London, and that's going to...
And local elections around the
country. Local elections are coming around the corner. And how is that all dealt with? Do they have to, you know, like, take all those presenters down? And let's be honest, the figures seem to demonstrate that that's actually only those politicians, serving politicians, that are actually bringing in the audience in the first place.
It is worth noting that actually Esther McVeigh and Philip Davis gave up their show when Esther went up into the cabinet. And so it's actually only Rees-Mogg that's now a serving politician that's on the books, because that was against the rules and they did abide by that.
And Lee...
Yes.
Lee Anderson.
Lee Anderson, yes. Yeah. James, in Australia, the old boss of GB News used to run Sky News Australia. How does that do? Because that's in a similar mould.
Yeah, it is in a similar mold. I mean, I should say that we get GB News in Australia as well. It's popped up on both pay TV channels there. The ad breaks are full of promos saying 7 o'clock on Saturday, which of course makes absolutely no sense whatsoever if you're watching it in Australia. So I'm not quite sure what's going on there. Sky News Australia does incredibly well in terms of setting the agenda. Mm. It's not available on terrestrial TV in the capital cities. It is available on terrestrial TV outside of that, and of course it's on Foxtel as you would expect. It's got ex-politicians hosting it, but no current politicians, which is there. I think it's important to remember that there's no impartiality rules in Australia at all. So Sky News Australia is, it's more far right than Fox News is, you know, in the US. It's quite a watch.
So GB News is the voice of reason in Australia.
So as a result, everybody assumes that the ABC is far left, whereas actually the ABC is middle ground, but it looks far left in comparison to, you know, the big AM talkback stations, 2GB, but also Sky News. So yes, absolutely.
One of the big stories of the year has been about cuts to BBC local radio programming. Chris Burns is the head of audio and digital for BBC England and responsible for 39 local radio stations. We sent broadcast consultant Paul Robinson to speak with her this week, and they began by discussing how the plan's going.
Well, we've set our target across the whole of BBC local that we want to reach 50% of the population in England. So that's our target. And that would include TV, online, social and sound sign-in. So that's what we're looking to do. I mean, at the moment, if you were to take our local radio stations, what we do online and what we do in terms of our TV programmes, I mean, our 6:30 programmes that are still broadcast are the most watched TV news programme the BBC produces. So, you know, we're not doing badly in lots of areas, but we believe we can genuinely grow that even more than we've currently got. I think we're in most places now about 45%. But, you know, we need to set a stretch target. I think that's the right thing to do. And if we are actually resourcing those areas like social properly, like looking at how we're developing, what our proposition is going to be on sounds, how we develop the local rail, how we develop sport more. You know, is there more we can do in terms of the long read on sport? Because of all the commentary we've got, there's probably more we can do there. I think if we use all of those levers at our disposal, we can actually touch more people.
Change is always difficult, and you come in for some criticism for the changes you've made. What would you say to those people who've been critical, maybe, of the most recent changes at BBC Local Radio?
I was on a walk in Northampton in November. It was a Children in Need walk. And I was walking with a group of Radio Northampton listeners, and they didn't necessarily know who I was at the start of the day. And as we walked, obviously, when you're walking for 6 hours, you talk. And I explained what my role was. And they talked to me a lot about what they thought of the current changes. And one woman was saying to me, she was describing how intimate the relationship with the radio was. And I said to her, I said, does it feel as if somebody's come into your living room and rearranged the furniture? She said, that's exactly how it feels. I said, right, I understand that. And I explained what we were trying to do. And she said, well, that makes sense. I understand what you're trying to do, but I still want these things. And I said, look, I think what we have to do is we've introduced a lot of change in a relatively short space of time. I think we will need to look at that. We may need to go back and tweak some things. Have we got everything right? I think it would be arrogant of me to sit here now and think, well, that was that's the perfect plan. We don't need to look at anything. Of course we will look at things. We need to look at the audience measures. We need to look at what's working, perhaps what's not working, and we will tweak accordingly. Because creativity and radio should always be iterative. You should always be growing. You should always be developing. I mean, I'm sitting here today, you know, listening to Greg James talking about how he uses the audience, listening to Mariana Spring and how she builds trust amongst some of the people who've got some very deep-rooted and personal things to talk about. But there were lots of things that I've noticed today that we all share in common. And I think this is where we need to be true to a series of principles. We do need to listen to the audience, and we do need to be bold enough to react. We also need to be authentic. We need to give prominence to stories, and we need to hear from the audience and use the audience more within our programming and put them at the front and centre of everything that we do. But I also believe that we will be stronger in local if we use all the platforms at our disposal.
You've talked about news, you've talked about the local rail, you've talked about local radio. Let's talk about podcasts. And one of the successes is Love Bombed, made by Radio Newcastle. What are your thoughts about future podcasting, and how will you leverage that sort of production expertise that exists in those 39 local radio stations to create podcasts for BBC Sounds?
So I think what we need to find, I think, in local, or what are the things that we can deliver that no one else can deliver? For me, it's stories of the place and giving them greater prominence. So things like Love Bombed, also the kidnapping of Stephanie Slater. You know, those are stories where actually the reporting team in those areas have built a bond of trust, which means that people are much more likely to talk to you and talk freely and really trust you to develop that story. I think there is more potentially we can do around sport and, you know, how we really kind of dial up the fandom element, which, again, we could be much more partisan than other areas of the BBC. And there's also probably something we can do more around, you know, my moment in history. We did a series a couple of years ago now around the Falklands, and it was made by BBC Radio Solent. They went to the Falklands, but also it's the story of the soldiers who went out there, the people who are on the Falklands. And one woman, it still lives with me forever, she told the story about how she went to school on the Friday and she was being taught in English. She went on the Monday and she was being taught in Spanish. And it's a connection with the place that means we are best able, I think, to bring those stories to life. And those are stories that are very much rooted in local, but they've got a national and in some cases an international appeal.
Could you maybe sort of confirm, because I think people have asked the question really, are you, as the BBC, committed to local radio? Will local radio still be around in 5-10 years' time?
I'm absolutely committed to local radio. I want us to have strong local radio stations. You know, there are lots of different things we could have done, but the fact that we still have 39 local radio stations across the whole of England. And I learnt during COVID one thing very early on. The story of COVID was different from place to place. Yeah. There was the story in Cornwall, there was the story in Newcastle, there was the story in Leicester, which was not the same as the story in Nottingham and Derby. Mm. So keeping those 39 bases is absolutely vital. But I do think we need to see those local services being local production hubs, because that way, you know, what you will see across the BBC is audiences will see their lives reflected back. And that is something I believe local can deliver.
Chris Burns, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Chris Burns speaking to Paul Robinson this week at Radio Days Europe, our thanks to them. James, what did you think of what she had to say?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, her target of 50% of the population of England listening to or watching consuming. Of course, that includes TV. She's currently on 12% just on local radio. She didn't mention podcasts. She only mentioned BBC Sounds. So any of this fancy money that'll be coming into the podcasts don't actually matter there. The one thing that I did notice, so I thought, okay, well, she's very much focusing on online here. I used to live up in West Yorkshire. I wonder how many news stories have been posted from Leeds today. Went to have a look. 6. And I followed a link. There was one story about Bradford. I followed a link that was marked Bradford, and I got a page from the BBC website that was last updated in March 2015. So I thought, yikes, there's a thing.
It's interesting that they're trying to change an audio organisation into a broader digital organisation, and they've obviously lost a lot of staff, which is very sad. Mm. The ambition to reach 50% with BBC Local content isn't a bad one. But as you kind of point out, that it's a big challenge to make that work.
Well, and also crucially, we, the public, won't get to see those other measures, because we get to see Radar, and I can point to 12%, and there we are. But in terms of the BBC Sounds data, in terms of podcasts, in terms, frankly, of, you know, some of the regional TV stuff, it's much harder to actually work out how close they're getting. So we almost have to just assume that they are telling us the truth when they give us some of these numbers. So I do look at that, and I shake my head a little bit. But I have to say, some of the changes in local radio are needed, and they haven't handled them well at all. But if you have a look at how local radio works in most other markets, the BBC is moving a little bit closer into that kind of area.
And we'll be back with more media news after this.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day a Japanese inventor helped blind people cross the street.
Then on Tuesday, we tell the epic tale of Barcelona's La Sagrada Familia.
On Wednesday, the day the French blamed the Black Death on astrology.
Thursday was the day the last prisoners left Alcatraz.
And on Friday, we revisit the opening of SeaWorld. But where's baby Shamu?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcast.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home.
Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Welcome back, Frez. James and Alex are here with more news in brief. A couple of Channel 4 stories for you. This week, the top team were awarded bonuses, but at a reduced rate. Last year, their bonuses were waived. Frez, Broadcasting Union Bec2 calls it a slap in the face. Is it?
Yeah, it feels a little bit tone deaf. There was part of the statement said that it was about kind of the best talent retention, while they're also making redundancies at the best at the current time. And you know, the TV industry is having a real moment, to put it politely. And a lot of TV producers like myself are really, you know, honestly struggling. It's really hard to get work. And so when you see money being spent on remuneration packages that is rewarding, you know, is giving bonuses for performance, but it doesn't look like the performance is great. I think one of the things that I would say about this is that it's quite easy to have quite a knee-jerk reaction to, oh my God, they're getting bonuses and that's not fair. I always say that, look, I don't really care how much any media organisation gets paid, you know, to at the top, so long as they are creating commissions and creating opportunities for people like myself and other production companies and the freelance community. So that's where it feels like it's uneven right now. I think that you should get rewarded as a commercially, you know, as a public service broadcaster, but it's commercially led. If you can continue to grow the channel and continue to bring in more income into that channel that allows you to spend more money on programs, then yes, of course, you should be rewarded for that because the whole industry benefits. It's difficult to see that happening here. I think a bit more scrutiny as to kind of why you get awarded bonuses is required, and a bit more transparency. If they got those bonuses, they should be saying, we got these bonuses because of XYZ. Mm. We didn't get our full bonuses because of XYZ. That's not the messaging that I've seen come out.
Should they recalibrate their bonuses to sort of reigniting the TV industry?
Well, I mean, I think that the bonuses should exist to ignite the TV industry at all times. I don't think there should be any discrepancy there. But I think what you're suggesting is that they use that money and put it into commissioning more programs. My view is, yes, of course, commissioning programs, commissioning more creativity, getting more stuff to audiences should always be the priority over exec pay. I'd be quite surprised if anybody disagreed with that. But I just, again, this is another case of, honestly, Channel 4 being a bit tone deaf in what's going on in the market and then having to release these statements. I know they need to do it. They need to remunerate people. The annual report's coming out. They need to get ahead of it. They need to put the statements out. But I think they could be a bit smarter in how they suggest it.
Alex, this week also saw Derry Girls writer Lisa McGee take her latest project to Netflix. Why did Channel 4... get out of that deal?
I think there was some agreement between Lisa Channel 4 and Channel 4 that this upcoming comedy thriller she's working on, How to Get to Heaven from Belfast, had kind of morphed into something that it wasn't quite in development. Now that's and Netflix came in and was prepared to fund it. They thought that's a good idea for us. Now, you know, things get put into development all the time. They don't always end up at the broadcaster that invests in them in the first instance. Obviously, Lisa McGee's got a great relationship with Channel 4 through years and years of the outstanding Derry Girls, and so there was an expectation that show would end up with 4. But you know, as Faraz was saying, Channel 4's in tough times. It's got to think carefully. You know, Netflix isn't necessarily flush with money at the moment, but you know, so arguably, you know, we should be celebrating the fact that Lisa's still able to get shows away no matter where they are.
Faraz, is it just one of those things, or does it look to something else being problematic?
Well, this show in particular going to Netflix.
Yeah.
I think that we are in a market, and I actually kind of welcome this. I think that we should have as many customers as possible trying
it's good
to buy
there's
UK
a bit of a
content.
Bidding war.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, and I, you know, is it the best news for Channel 4? I don't think it's like the Black Mirror story. So, for people of a greyer hair complexion than myself. Well, actually, I'm in that camp now. Let's be honest. But there was a lot of story about how
people Channel can 4... see the YouTube for us.
No, get away with it. But Channel 4 obviously kicked off Black Mirror. Charlie Brooker took it to them, and it was a massive hit for Channel 4. And then there was a bit of a kerfuffle because Netflix swooped in and effectively created a production company and bought the production company from Charlie and Black Mirror alongside.
And that came because Channel 4 at that point, and it was a whole sort of different group of people that made that decision, but they sort of forced Charlie to get some co-funding. Then it all sort of fell apart, and so he took it to Netflix.
Yeah, and I would argue that the brand is the Black Mirror brand is much better as a result, and viewers who are subscribers to Netflix are getting much better shows as a result, because it's an incredibly expensive show, because effectively it's a film every episode. It's a completely brand new story, and I don't think it would have been sustainable for a public service broadcaster.
But let's not paint it as poor old Channel 4. Let's not remember, it wasn't too long ago that Channel 4 came in and poached Bake Off from BBC
and
Taskmaster from Dave.
I mean, they say that is kind of instantly profitable for them, though.
Yeah.
So that's a good business deal because it's cash straight in. It's a place that they can show off their own programming. But obviously, we've talked about it in the past, it does sort of point to a bit of a creative gap in what the next hit shows are. Right, elsewhere, YMU has been sold again, this time to private lending company Permira Credit as part of a wider deal with their parent company. YMU, Alex, it's an agency, isn't it? They look after a lot of people. There's some production in there as well. They had pretty high debt. How are things now with them?
I think it'll be interesting to see how this deal unfolds. They have got a lot of high-profile talent. Simon Cowell, Graham Norton, Claudia Winkleman, you know, it'll be interesting to see. Obviously, agencies are built on the talent that they've got. You know, M&A always creates change and movement. And, you know, it'll be crucial for YMU to hang on to that talent in order for Premiera to realise its value.
For us last year, Schofield was the name that was mentioned probably the most with YMU.
You see, never heard of him.
Obviously, not with them anymore. But now they've expanded Shits and Gigs, Amelia de Moldenberg, a lot more digital first talent. Is that where it's got to go for agencies?
I think YMU's been quite an interesting company from the outside because it has... It's not just a talent agency, and I think they've always pitched themselves as being more than just a talent agency. So they have invested heavily in both creating their own content and building brands. And that seems to be the trend across lots of talent agencies. Insanity have done a really, really good job of it as well, where they've actually created almost like a whole podcast wing where a lot of their talent is making some really great podcasts through their partnerships team at Insanity. And I think that there are many other talent agencies that are doing the same, that they see themselves as creators, not just the, you know, the agents for creatives. And so YMU, it feels, and you know, I haven't got the numbers to this, but kind of anecdotally from the outside, it feels that YMU were a bit more aggressive in this space and trying to make a lot more content and be seen in that world. How successful they've been in that, they've been in a changing space. So, you know, there was a podcast boom that slowed down right now. There is a digital boom. Is that going to continue, or is that starting to slow down right now? But there are always breakthrough talent, as you mentioned. And the game, I think, for talent agencies is to get to that talent first and fresh rather than signing them later on when they become very expensive.
James, kind of podcasting, there's been a bit of coverage recently about how every announcement has a big name attached to it. Is that essential to have a successful show? And so does it make these talent agencies who are involved in production a little bit as well, be in a really good place?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly makes it easier to market a big show is if you have a big name, you know, attached to it. I found it interesting. There's a company called Cast Media that just filed for bankruptcy in the US. And I spent actual US dollars in buying their bankruptcy papers so that I could see who they were owing money to. And what I found fascinating is they own somewhere in the region of 6 point something million, you know, US dollars. But a lot of the talent who they owe money to seems to be, you know, name of company, care of UTA. And UTA, big agent, of course, in the US. And, so all of a sudden you can actually see that they have inserted themselves into these deals in a way that, you know, possibly you wouldn't necessarily have expected, you know, to end up seeing. So, yeah, I think, and I find it, you know, again, interesting that the podcast show in London in a couple of months' time, that will have speakers from some of the large some of the large agencies, and they are bringing their talent along to actually hawk those as well.
Okay, just enough time for the media quiz. This week entitled, Can You Be More Specific? I'll give you a headline that could come from any episode of the media podcast. This is Producer Matt's most cynical, everybody. And you try to fill in the details for this week in particular. So buzz in with your names if you know the answer. So Faraz, you will say...
Faraz! Sorry, I'll say it again. Faraz.
Alex will say...
Alex.
And James will say...
James.
Here we go. Let's play Can You Be More Specific? Number one, BBC apologises.
Alex.
Yes.
This is...
you had to think there about which of all of the things.
This is the story about the BBC... Yeah, what does it... What's it apologised for lately?
Yeah.
It's got a lot to apologise for. No, this is the story about it calling the Reform Party far right in its copy. There was a report about the political party, I think it's a political party organisation, in which on the BBC News website, run by Richard Tice, and it was described as far right. Now, it subsequently emerged that they'd taken agency copy, right, which had described Tice's organisation as such. The agency submitted a correction. The correction wasn't taken in. You know, it's a process thing. Mistakes happen.
And they weren't the only ones to do it, were they?
Yeah, Jake Cantor said that Daily Mail did the same things.
Because they were using agency copy, though, you see, not because it was the same people making the same mistake. It was someone at PA, poor sod, dropped the ball, used the wrong phrasing, got picked up around the world. They retracted it. Other organisations were slower off the mark.
They're not far wrong in saying that they're
saying. Well, there is a question like, what is far right? What is right? What is far right?
What's a viewpoint? What's a fact and what's a viewpoint?
Okay, question number two. Well done, Alex. Point for you. Question number two. Channel 4 confirms experienced head of department to leave.
Faraz. Although yes. There's like three of them. I'm going to go with...
Well, I've got two, so if you can get both of them...
Well, there's three now. Oh, okay. There's three now. So Carl Warner, who's the head of youth and E4... I think was the first to be announced, and then from
he's been there about 6 years, I think.
Yeah, he's been there for looking after role, E4 since pretty much for a while, and then Alf Laurie was announced last week, and then I think today Caroline Hollick, who's the head of drama, was announced. So there's everything comes in three in tellies. So there's your three, but they are, I would argue, three incredible creatives, and I think a real loss to Channel 4.
Caroline was of course behind It's a Sin. Some points for you there. We'll work on that later. Right, so question number three. New presenter confirmed on long-running news programme.
Oh. Alex.
Alex, yes.
Emma Barnett?
Correct.
So this is the news that Emma Barnett currently hosts Women's Hour for BBC Radio 4. She'll be setting the alarm clock a little bit earlier because she's going to be doing the Today programme.
Shock.
Martha Kearney announced she's going to be stepping back, I think, after the general election. Mm. And I think Emma's stepping up in
pretty soon, I think, April, May. James, good decision, having Emma on the Today programme?
Yeah, I think so. She, absolutely. You know, a younger voice, you know, one that will be familiar to Radio 4 audiences. Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
A great reporter. So it'll be interesting to see how she does there. So well done, Alex. You've won the quiz. You get to investigate how far right the Reform Party are. Please come back with your thoughts. My thanks to Fraz Osmond, James Cridland, and Alex Farber. James, where can people keep up with you and your travels?
Oh, well, I write a daily newsletter all about podcasting and on demand. It's free and it's available in your email inbox, podnews.net.
That's podnews.net. Faraz?
I'm Fosman on Instagram. Goldweller is gold_Weller. Everywhere. We've got a doc out on BET and My5 at the moment called Garms, which I'm really proud of. Anybody that wants some stuff made, give me a call because I want to make it.
You know where to find him. And Alex, how can people follow your excellent journalism?
Well, just subscribe to The Times. Good digital packages available and available in all good news agents.
Excellent. Thank you all. Remember, there's 25% off your first booking at the London Podcast Studios, where we record our show each week. That's when you use the code MEDIAPOD. So just head to thelondonpodcaststudios.com. That's thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off using the code MEDIAPOD. If you're new to the show, make sure you hit follow on your podcast app of choice. My name is Matt Deegan. The producer was Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. I'll see you soon.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the two-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.